I was in both cases specifically requested by the organizers to give this particular talk. So I will do I'll do what I'm told. It will link up nicely with the talk that David Wallace just gave. Let me start off by reminding you of what I take to be the simplest and most beautiful and most seductive way of understanding what it was that Everett first decisively put his finger on 50 years ago now. It's this, I take it. There's supposed to be a problem with the linear, deterministic, unitary quantum mechanical equations of motion. And that problem, in its clearest and most vivid and most radical form, runs something like this. The equations of motion, if they apply to everything, entail that in the event that somebody measures, say, the x spin of an electron whose y spin is initially up, then the state of the world when the experiment is over is with certainty going to be a superposition with equal coefficients of one state in which the x spin of the electron is up, and the measuring device indicates that that spin is up, and the human experimenter believes that that spin is up, and another state in which the x spin of the electron is down, and the measuring device indicates that that spin is down, and the human experimenter believes that that spin is down. And superpositions like that, on the standard way of thinking about what it is to be in a superposition, are situations in which there is no matter of fact about what the value of the x spin of the electron is, or about what the measuring device indicates about that value, or about what the human experimenter believes about that value. And the problem with that is that we know with certainty, by means of direct introspection, that there is a matter of fact, at least about what we believe about the value of the x spin of an electron like that, once we're done measuring it. And so the superposition just described can't possibly be the way experiments like that end up. And so the quantum mechanical equations of motion must be false or incomplete, or that, at any rate, was the conventional wisdom. And it was Everett who first pointed us in the direction of a scientifically realist strategy for resisting precisely this conventional wisdom. It was Everett who first remarked that the problem rehearsed above is in fact ill-posed. It was Everett who first argued, more particularly, that precisely the same linearity of the quantum mechanical equations of motion, which gives rise to the troubling superpositions of brain states described above, also radically undermines the reliability of the sorts of introspective reports with which those superpositions are supposed to be incompatible. And the suggestion here, the intriguing possibility here, is that perhaps there's nothing wrong with the equations of motion and nothing incomplete about them after all. And there have been a host of questions ever since about how to go on from there. And I want to focus on one particularly difficult such question in my remarks today, the question we've already been talking about a lot today, the question of how to make sense in the context of the sort of picture of the world that Everett seems to be suggesting, of all of the apparently indispensable quantum mechanical talk of probabilities. And as lots of people have said, the kind of talk one has in mind here includes our use of probabilities as a guide to life, and as a component of explanation, and as a tool of confirmation, and so on. There's a simple and straightforward and perfectly obvious sort of worry here, a worry that'll be worth putting on the table at the outset in two slightly different forms. One, and this is ground we've been over too. One, Everettian pictures of the world are apparently going to have no room in them for ignorance about the future. The worry is that the Everettian picture of the world, whatever precisely that picture is going to turn out to be, is going to be completely deterministic. And moreover, it's going to impose none of the sorts of ignorance of the initial conditions that allow us to make sense of probabilistic talk in deterministic theories like classical statistical mechanics and Bohmian mechanics. Second way to put the worry. Everettian pictures of the world are apparently not going to be susceptible of confirmation or disconfirmation by means of experiment. Not at any rate by means of anything even remotely like the sorts of experiments we normally take to be confirmatory of quantum mechanics. Why, for example, should it come as a surprise on a picture like this to see what we would ordinarily consider a low probability string of experimental results? Why should such a result cast any doubt on the truth of this theory, as it does, in fact, cast doubt on quantum mechanics? Okay, let me give some of the prehistory of this discussion, some of the first passes at responding to worries like this. Everybody's first unreflective reaction to these sorts of worries is to think of the probability in question here as the probability that the real me, or the original me, or the sentient me, or something like that, ends up at the conclusion of a measurement on this or that particular branch of the wave function. And the serious discussion of these questions gets underway precisely with the realization that insofar as the Everett picture is committed to the proposition that quantum mechanical wave functions amount to metaphysically complete descriptions of the world, if it's the Everett picture we're dealing with, then these sorts of thoughts just make no sense. An attempt to modify, a preposterous attempt to modify, an attempt, by the way, due to myself and Barry Lohr from many years ago, to escape from this was to go an explicitly dualist route and propose the so-called many minds interpretation of quantum mechanics, where something like that could literally be true. Very little needs to be said about why that ought not be taken seriously. Here's another idea. Suppose that we measure the X spin of each of an infinite ensemble of electrons, where each of the electrons in the ensemble is prepared initially in the state alpha X up plus beta X down. Then it can easily be shown, and David was referring to this in his talk, that in the limit as the number of measurements already performed goes to infinity, the state of the world approaches an eigenstate of the frequency of, say, up results with eigenvalue alpha squared. And note, and this is a piece of what's seductive about this view that David didn't emphasize so much because he was rightly criticizing it. Note that the limit we're dealing with here is a perfectly concrete and flat-footed limit of a sequence of vectors in Hilbert space, and not a limit of probabilities of the sort that we're used to dealing with in applications of the probabilistic law of large numbers. And the thought has occurred to a number of investigators. This is the thought that occurred to Sidney Coleman. I had written things like this at various times. Others had too. That perhaps all it means to say that the probability that the outcome of a measurement of the X spin of an electron in the state alpha X up plus beta X down is alpha squared, that all it means to say that is that if an infinite ensemble of such experiments were to be performed, the state of the world would with certainty approach an eigenstate of the frequency of, say, up results with eigenvalue alpha squared. And what's particularly beautiful and seductive about that thought is the intimation that perhaps the Everett picture will turn out, at the end of the day, to be the only picture of the world on which probabilities fully and flat-footedly and non-circularly make sense. But the business of parlaying this thought into a fully worked-out account of probability in the Everett picture quickly runs into very familiar and very discouraging sorts of trouble. One doesn't know what to say, for example, about finite runs of experiments, and one doesn't know what to say about the fact that the world is, after all, very unlikely ever to be in an eigenstate of my undertaking to carry out any particular measurement of anything, and so on. Good. But there has lately been a very imaginative and very intriguing and very intensely discussed third pass at all this. And this is due, among others, to David Deutsch and David Wallace and Hilary Greaves and Simon Saunders and Wayne Myhrvold and others. And this approach exploits the formal apparatus of decision theory. And this third approach is going to be my topic here. Let me start off with what seems to me to be the clearest and the most straightforward and the most radical version of this idea, the version of Greaves, and I think of Deutsch as well. The version that David Wallace refers to in a very nice picture is the fission program. The point of departure here is to eschew any talk of probabilities whatsoever. This is what Simon was referring to as the incoherence approach. One eschews all talk of probabilities. One acknowledges, frankly, that in a world like this, this being a deterministic world with none of the relevant ignorance of initial conditions, there just aren't any things like that. The situation, rather, is this. The Schrodinger evolution is the complete story of the evolution of the world, or the relativistic generalizations of Schrodinger evolution. Every branch in the appropriate basis supports an actual experience of the observer. Every quantum mechanically possible outcome of a measurement occurs with certainty. What I should rationally expect on undertaking a measurement is to say all, or sometimes people prefer to say each, of its possible outcomes with certainty. In every sequence of similar measurements, all of the possible frequencies occur and are experienced by the observer with certainty, period. And now the following question is raised. Imagine that this is actually the way the world is. And suppose that our preferences are given. We want, say, to maximize our financial holdings, and we don't care about anything else. How is it rational for us to act? What is it rational for us to decide under these circumstances? And there's a whole collection of arguments that we've heard talked of today and that I'm going to talk of again. There's a whole collection of arguments to the effect that the square of the absolute value of the coefficient of this or that particular branch is going to play precisely the same formal role in rational deliberations about how to act in a world like that as the probability of this or that particular state of affairs plays in such deliberations in the analogous, genuinely chancy world. There's a whole collection of arguments, that is, to the effect that the square amplitudes in the many worlds interpretation are going to play precisely the same role in decision theory as probabilities do in chancy theories. And the thought is that that's all we need. The thought is that that exhausts the roles that probabilities play in our lives. How precisely should we think of these amplitudes on the fission picture if the sort of argument just described succeeds? What they certainly are not, remember, are probabilities. Greaves thinks that what these sorts of arguments establish, if they succeed, is that rational agents must treat the square amplitude as what she calls a caring measure, a measure of the degree to which we care about the situation on this or that particular branch. Our goal in making decisions, then, is to maximize the average over all the branches of the product of how well we do on a branch and the degree to which we care about what happens on that branch. And I have two distinct worries about this strategy. One worry has to do with whether or not these arguments actually succeed in establishing the particular point they're advertised as establishing, whether or not, that is, these arguments actually succeed in establishing that the square of the absolute value of the coefficient of this or that particular branch is going to play precisely the same role in rational deliberations about how to act in a world like that as the probability of this or that particular state of affairs plays in such deliberations in the analogous, genuinely chancy world. And the other worry has to do with whether or not establishing that, even if it could be established, would amount to anything along the lines of a solution to the puzzle about probabilities in the many worlds interpretation. Let me talk about the second one of these worries, the more abstract and general of those two worries first. The worry here is that the question at which this entire program is aimed, the question out of which the entire program arises, is the wrong question. The question to which this program is addressed, The question to which this program is addressed are questions of what we would do if we believed that the fission hypothesis were true. But the question at issue here is precisely whether to believe the fission hypothesis is true. And what needs to be looked into in order to answer that question has nothing at all to do with how we would act if we believed that the answer to that question were yes. What needs to be looked into in order to answer the question of whether to believe that the fission hypothesis is correct is the empirical adequacy of that hypothesis. What needs to be looked into in order to answer the question of whether to believe the fission hypothesis is correct is whether or not the truth of that hypothesis is explanatory of our empirical experience. And that experience is of certain particular sorts of experiments having certain particular sorts of outcomes with certain particular sorts of frequencies and not with others. And the fission hypothesis, since it's committed to the claim that all such experiments have all possible outcomes with all possible frequencies, is structurally incapable of explaining anything like that. Yes? Fission hypothesis is the hypothesis that it is the following approach to everything. Let's not talk about probabilities. We just split. There are no probabilities here. There are no chances in this world. I'm not going to try to develop a strategy for talking about probabilities. I'm going to refrain from using probability talk. But what I'm going to be, what I'm going to show is that an observer who takes himself to be in a world like that, who knows he's going to split like this, would behave just as if there were probabilities. Okay.
What's the fishing?
The splitting. The branch.
Oh, the branch.
That's the fishing.
Thank you.
Okay. Good.
Let's see where I was.
Okay, good. And the fission hypothesis, since it's committed to the claim that all such experiments have all possible outcomes with all possible frequencies, is just from the word go, not even going to be in the game of trying to explain facts about why the frequency is this as opposed to that. There are no determinate frequencies on this view. The decision theoretic program seems to act as if what primarily and in the first instance stands in need of being explained about the world is why we bet the way we do. But this is crazy. Even if the arguments in question here were to succeed, even, that is, if it could be demonstrated that any rational agent who believed in the fission hypothesis would bet just as we do, that would merely show that circumstances can be imagined, circumstances which, mind you, are altogether different from those of our actual empirical experience, circumstances in which the betting, in which the business of betting on X has nothing at all to do with the business of guessing at whether or not X is going to occur. There could be circumstances like that in which, as it happens, we would bet just as we do now. For us, on the other hand, the business of betting has everything in the world to do with the business of guessing at whether or not X is going to occur. And the guesses we make are, in the best cases, a rational reaction to what we see. The guesses we make are, in the best cases, informed by the frequencies of relevantly similar occurrences in the past. And it is those frequencies, and not the betting behaviors to which they ultimately give rise, which make up the raw data of our experience. It is those frequencies, or at any rate, the appearance of those frequencies, and not the betting behaviors to which they ultimately give rise, which primarily, and in the first instance, stand in need of a scientific explanation. And the thought that one might be able to get away without explaining those frequencies or their appearances, the thought that one might be able to get away to make some sort of an end run around explaining those frequencies or their appearances, which seems to be the central thought of the decision theoretic strategy, is, when you think about it, crazy. There's a sleight of hand going on here. There's a bait and switch. What we need is an account of our actual empirical experience of frequencies. And what we're promised, and this is already something which falls entirely short of what we need, is an account of why we bet the way we do. And what we're given, which falls again entirely short even of what we were promised, is an argument to the effect that if we held an altogether different set of convictions about the world than the ones we actually hold, we would bet the same way that we actually do. And on top of all of that, and this brings me to the first and more concrete and more technical of the two worries I mentioned above, the argument itself seems to me not to work. Let's look then at the detail of the argument, and this is the first of the objections I've mentioned. These arguments all start out by asking us to consider the following set of circumstances. Let alpha payoff up there represent the state of the world in which I'm given a certain sum of money and in which the state of the rest of the world is alpha. And let beta, no payoff, represent the state of the world in which I'm given no money and in which the state of the rest of the world is beta. And suppose that my only interest is in maximizing my wealth. Suppose, in particular, that I am altogether indifferent as to whether alpha or beta obtains as the state of the rest of the world. Then, on pain of irrationality, the utility I associate with state number one must be equal to the utility I associate with state number two, because these two states differ only in terms of the roles of alpha and beta, and I am, by stipulation, indifferent as to whether it's alpha or beta that obtains in the rest of the world. Or that, at any rate, is what these arguments claim. And that claim, as we've heard today, goes under the name of equivalence in the literature. And it turns out that once the hypothesis of equivalence is granted, the game is over. It turns out that supposing equivalence amounts to supposing that whatever it is that plays the functional role of probabilities can depend on nothing other than the quantum mechanical amplitudes. And it turns out to be relatively easy to argue from there to the conclusion that these functional probabilities can be nothing other than the absolute squares of those amplitudes. And the worry is, and this is a worry that David mentioned in his talk, the worry is that all of the initial plausibility of this hypothesis seems on a little reflection, or threatens on a little reflection, to melt away. For suppose that I adopt a caring measure, the one that David mentioned, different contra the equivalence hypothesis, that depends on the difference between alpha and beta. Suppose, for example, that I decide that the degree to which it's reasonable for me to care about what transpires on some particular one of my future branches ought to be proportional to how fat I am on that branch. The thought being that since there's more of me on the branches where I'm fatter, those branches deserve to attract more of my concern about the future. Would there be something incoherent or irrational or unreasonable in that? Would it somehow make less sense for me to adopt my fatness as a caring measure than it would for me to adopt the absolute square of the quantum mechanical amplitude as a caring measure? Well, let's think it through. Hilary Greaves has pointed out, and David made mention of a worry like this in his talk too, has pointed out that a caring measure that depends exclusively on how fat I am probably isn't going to work, since the coherence of a measure like that is going to depend on there being some perfectly definite matter of fact about exactly how many branches there are. And as David repeated many times, there are very unlikely to turn out to be any facts like that. But this is easily remedied by replacing the naive fatness measure, the one that depends exclusively on how fat I am, with a slightly more sophisticated one. Let the degree to which I care about what transpires on a certain branch then be proportional to how fat I am on that branch multiplied by the absolute square of the amplitude associated with that branch. It's sometimes been suggested that by moving from the standard quantum mechanical square amplitude caring measure to the sophisticated form of the fatness measure, is, as a matter of fact, when you get right down to it, notwithstanding superficial appearances to the contrary, not really a case of changing my caring measure at all, but rather a case of changing my preferences, a case of deciding that I want not only to be rich, but to be fat as well. It has sometimes been suggested, to put it slightly differently, that my adopting such a measure would somehow be inconsistent with the claim, or somehow irrational in light of the claim, that I am, as a matter of fact, entirely indifferent to whether I'm fat or thin. But this is a mistake. I can perfectly well have no preference at all when faced with a choice between two different non-branching deterministic future evolutions, in one of which I get fat, and in the other of which I get thin, and at the same time be very eager to arrange things when I am faced with an upcoming branching event so as to ensure that things are to my liking on the branch where I'm fatter. What would explain such behavior? What would make sense of such behavior? Precisely the conviction I mentioned above, that where branching events are concerned, but only where branching events are concerned, there's more of me to be concerned about on those branches where I'm fatter. In the non-branching cases, no such considerations can come into play, since in those cases, the entirety of me, fat or thin, is on the single branch to come. So, although my present concern about the overall well-being of my descendants is in general going to involve my caring a great deal about their relative fatnesses, those same fatnesses are going to involve my caring a great, those same fatnesses are going to be no concern at all of those descendants themselves. And once again, there's nothing worrisome or paradoxical or mysterious in that. In cases of branching, after all, there's no reason at all why my interests at T1, vis-a-vis the circumstances of my descendants at T2, should coincide with the interests of any particular one of my descendants at T2, vis-a-vis his circumstances at T2. In cases of branching, my concerns now are going to embrace the entire weighted collection of my descendants, whereas their concerns are going to embrace only their individual selves and their descendants. Good. One more worry, and this is the worry that David alluded to in his talk. David Wallace has pointed out that acting in accord with a fatness caring measure might sometimes prove difficult in practice. It might, for example, involve my trying to anticipate or even taking measures to try to control, as David described, how much I'm going to eat on this or that future branch. Let me say two things about this, the second of which I think is the more important. First of all, difficulties like this could presumably be reduced or perhaps even eliminated altogether by other more judicious choices of a caring measure. But that doesn't seem to me the main point here. The more important point is that the existence or non-existence of such difficulties seems altogether irrelevant to the question of what it's reasonable for me to care about. It hardly counts as news about the world, after all, that it can sometimes be difficult to bring about the sorts of situations that we judge most desirable. But it would be absurd to pretend that those situations are any less desirable for that. Forget for the moment about quantum mechanics and about branching and about chances. Here's a discussion that comes up all the time in undergraduate courses about decision theory. Consider the business of making a decision, and consider the business of tracing the consequence of my acting in such and such a way, at such and such a moment, all the way out to the end of time, in the face of a classical mechanical sort of determinism. Consider how easy it might be, for example, to imagine that my going to movie A rather than to movie B tonight might result in the deaths of millions of innocent people over the next several hundreds of thousands of years. We just don't know. We can't know. The calculations are utterly and permanently and inescapably beyond us. Ought we to pretend, then, that we don't care how many millions of people live or die as a result of what we do? Ought we to come to understand that, as a matter of fact, it doesn't matter how many millions of people live or die as a result of what we do? Certainly not. We do the best we can with what we have to bring about what we want. And when we find, and what we find we can't do, or what we find is excessively difficult to do, is maybe occasion for sadness or occasion for resignation, but it surely doesn't count as evidence that that isn't what we wanted in the first place, or that it was somehow incoherent to regard that as a better outcome in the first place. The worry, then, is that equivalence turns out to be false. And more than that, the worry is that it's not, in fact, one whit less rational in the face of the conviction that something like the fission picture is true for me to operate in accord with the sophisticated fatness measure than it is for me to operate in accord with the Born measure. And if that's true, then there can be no uniquely rational way of operating under such convictions at all. And the whole argument seems to fall apart. Let's back up and come at this again from a slightly different angle through the question of confirmation. Advocates of the fission hypothesis have argued that there's a very straightforward generalization of the standard Bayesian technique of confirmation, which can be applied to branching and to stochastic theories alike. And moreover, that such an application shows how the fission hypothesis is confirmed by our empirical experience of the world to precisely the same degree and by precisely the same evidence as a stochastic theory governed by the Born rule would be confirmed. And if all this is right, then much of what I've been saying here must somehow be wrong. Hilary Greaves has pointed out, for example, that if all this is right, then there just cannot be an objection to the fission hypothesis, to the effect that that hypothesis cannot explain the frequencies of the outcomes of the standard quantum mechanical experiments, since, after all, it's precisely those frequencies that are confirmatory of the fission hypothesis. But it seems to me that the application of Bayesianism to the fission hypothesis that investigators like Greaves and Myhrvold have in mind turns out, on closer examination, to be much less standard and much less straightforward and much less innocent than advertised. And this will be worth explaining carefully, and it'll be best to start at the beginning. Any sensible strategy, any sensible strategy for updating one's credence in this or that scientific theory in light of one's empirical experience of the world has presumably got to be a matter of considering how well or how poorly that experience bears out the proposition that the theory in question is true. Any sensible strategy for updating one's credence in this or that scientific theory in light of one's empirical experience of the world has presumably got to be a matter of evaluating how well or how poorly the theory does in predicting what's going to happen. In the standard Bayesian account of confirmation, for example, we decide how to update our credence in hypothesis H in light of some new item of evidence E by calculating what the probability of E would be if H were true. And our credence in H goes up, other things being equal, if E is the sort of occurrence that H counts as likely. Put that beside the discussions I mentioned above of Bayesian confirmation, or maybe neo-Bayesian confirmation, or maybe faux-Bayesian confirmation in the fission picture. The way Greaves and Myhrvold set things up, what needs to be evaluated is not what the probability of E would be if H were true, but rather how we would bet on E if we believed that H were true. And what they recommend is that those of my descendants who witness E ought to raise their credence in H, other things being equal, if E is the sort of occurrence that I would have bet on if I believed that H were true. But remember, and this is the absolutely crucial point, that deciding whether or not to bet on E in the fission picture has nothing whatsoever to do with guessing at whether or not E is going to occur. It is going to occur, for sure. And so is not E. And the decision and the business of deciding how to bet is just a matter of maximizing the payoffs on those particular branches that, for whatever reason, I happen to care the most about. And if one is careful to keep all that at the center of one's attention, and if one is careful not to be misled by the usual rhetoric of making a bet, then the epistemic strategy that Greaves and Myhrvold recommend suddenly looks, I don't know, silly and sneaky and unmotivated and not right. There surely is, okay, full stop. There surely is, on the other hand, a perfectly legitimate question about how one ought rightly to proceed. There's a perfectly legitimate question of what epistemic strategy one ought rightly to adopt once the possibility of branching is taken into account. And dispensing with the suggestion of Greaves and Myhrvold leaves that question, of course, altogether unanswered. Suppose, then, that we update our credences in accord with the standard Bayesian prescription, where the probability of E on H is stipulated to be the probability that E would occur if H were true. That won't work either. Greaves has very rightly pointed out that a policy like that would unreasonably favor a fission picture, that if we adopt a policy like that, our credence in the fission picture must rise and rise no matter what we see compared to any other theory, since every possible outcome of every possible measurement has probability one on that picture. This is an old puzzle about confirmation theory. Suppose I entertain the scientific hypothesis that everything happens all the time, okay? Every observation confirms this hypothesis. This hypothesis is clearly the best possible scientific theory. Something is wrong, okay? Let's try another tech. Suppose I have a device D, which prints out numerals on a tape, and I'm considering a number of theories about how this device D works. Consider, to begin with, the following two theories. One, the device, once each second, prints out one of the numerals, 1 through 10, with probability 1/10 for each particular numeral. Second theory, the device, once each second, prints out all of the numerals, 1 through 10, prints out all the numerals, 1 through 10. And suppose that the only empirical access I have to what is printed on the tape is by means of a measuring device, M, and suppose that M operates in the following way. When I press the button on M, M prints out one of the numerals that's on the D tape. If there's more than one numeral on the D tape, M prints out one of those numerals, but, and this is important, this is part of the structure of this device M, there are no rules whatever, neither strict nor probabilistic, that bear on the question of which one of those numerals, the largest one, say, or the one on the left, or the one in the middle, or the third one, or whatever, there are no rules about which one it prints. So the information I get by pressing this button on M is that the output numeral appears on the D tape, but I get no more information than that. Now, theory two, it seems to me, in circumstances like this, is going to associate no probability whatsoever with any particular output of the M device. And so there's going to be nothing at all to feed into the Bayesian updating formula. And so measurements with M can have no effect whatsoever on our relative credences between theory one and theory two. And I bring this example up because all of this strikes me as exactly analogous to the epistemic situation of an observer who remembers a certain string of experiments coming out a certain particular way and is wondering how those memories ought rightly to affect his comparative credences in a chancy understanding of quantum mechanics versus a fission understanding of quantum mechanics. I don't think these theories are going to be susceptible of confirmation. I think we're just not going to get the probabilities we need to feed into the Bayesian updating formula. One more comment about this. This was inspired by some stuff in papers of Greaves's, but it applies very much to what David Wallace was saying this morning, too. Look, and here's a complaint people make. Much of the complaining that I've been doing over the past 40 minutes or so takes it for granted that chances and frequencies, and also degrees of belief, but more importantly, chances and frequencies are very intimately tied up with one another. And advocates of the fission picture are constantly reminding us, as David did this morning, that we have no clear and perspicuous and uncontroversial analysis as yet of the links between chances and frequencies and rational degrees of belief. And they're fond of insisting as David sort of did this morning, that in the absence of such an analysis, all of the above complaints against the fishing picture are guilty of an implicit and unjustified double standard. The thought, I take it, is that in the absence of such an analysis, the absence of such an analysis somehow makes it clear that the chance of E can have no more to do with questions of whether or not E is going to occur than the caring measure of E does. And the absence of such an analysis somehow makes it clear that caring measures can be no less fit to the tasks of explanation and confirmation than chances are. But look, the first thing to say is that all this strikes me as wildly and almost willfully distorted. The point of a philosophical analysis of chance, especially an analysis in what David was calling the frequentist tradition, the point of a philosophical analysis of chance is not to establish that chances are related to frequencies, but among other things, to show precisely how chances are related to frequencies. And if it should somehow become clear that such an analysis is really impossible, if it should somehow become clear that no such analyzable relationship exists, then the very idea of chance will have been exposed as nonsense. And the project of statistical explanation will need to be abandoned, and we can all go home. But things are very unlikely, much less likely than David was portraying them, in my view, ever to get that bad. It's true, of course, that there is as yet no uncontroversial analysis of the links between chances and frequencies. Philosophy is hard, but there are plenty of smart people at work on the problem. And contrary to what David said, there are plenty of really interesting proposals on the table in a more or less frequentist sort of tradition. I'm thinking here especially of the tradition of thinking about this stuff that goes back to Lewis and which Barry Lower has continued in recent years in a very interesting way. There are already proposals on the table which seem to me to be very promising indeed along these lines. And it seems profoundly misleading to act as if our best guess at present is that there are no such describable links at all. And it goes without saying that nothing like that is true, and nothing like that is ever going to be true of the fishing picture. The fishing picture starts out, after all, precisely by denying that there is any determinate fact about the frequency with which such and such an experiment, such and such quantum mechanical experiment, has such and such an outcome. And so the possibility of explaining frequencies like that is out of the question from the word go. How much more time do I have? Okay, good, good. Let me back up to the beginning one more time, because there are a lot of different traditions of arguing about this. There's a very basic and very obvious and straightforward worry about whether or not anything along the lines of an Everettian picture of quantum mechanics can possibly make sense of the standard quantum mechanical talk about probabilities. A worry I mentioned at the outset of my remarks here, which runs as follows. Talk about the probability of this or that future event would seem to make no sense unless there's something about the future of which we are uncertain. And there seems to be no room for any such uncertainty in the context of anything along the lines of an Everettian picture. The strategy of the fishing picture, of course, and this is a strategy I admire, is to bite down hard on just that particular bullet and to propose a way of getting along without probabilities. But there are more, I don't know how to put it, there are more polite approaches on offer as well. There are a number of attempts in the literature at presenting things in such a way as to take away the ground of the sort of worry I just described. There are more particularly a number of attempts in the literature at analyzing the semantics of locutions of the form, I am uncertain about the outcome of this upcoming experiment, in such a way as to make it plausible, notwithstanding initial appearances to the contrary, that such locutions can amount to sensible descriptions of the epistemic situations of observers in a branching universe. And the idea, I take it, is that if such an analysis succeeds, it will make it possible to think of the argument from equivalence as fixing not merely a caring measure, but a measure of genuine probability. Now, there are subtle and interesting questions, which I think are worth a lot of discussion, but which I won't have time to talk about here. There are subtle and interesting questions about whether or not any of these semantic analyses actually succeed. There are subtle and interesting questions, indeed, about whether or not any merely semantic analysis can possibly succeed in making it plausible that locutions like "I am uncertain about the outcome of this upcoming experiment" can amount to sensible descriptions of the epistemic situations of observers in a branching universe. But look, insofar as our purposes here are concerned, I think all such questions can safely be put to one side, because even if one or another of the above-mentioned semantic analyses should succeed, it's apparently going to be fatal for the uncertainty picture, just as it was fatal for the fission picture, that the argument from equivalence doesn't succeed, or at least that there are worries about the argument from equivalence. But there's an idea of Lev Weidman's for introducing an altogether familiar and pedestrian sort of uncertainty into the Everett picture, an uncertainty that involves none of the fancy semantical footwork that we've just been talking about. And it's been suggested here and there in the decision theoretic literature that Lev's idea might afford another way of understanding the argument from equivalence as fixing a measure of probability. But suggestions like that are once again manifestly going to suffer the same fate and for precisely the same reasons as the fission picture and the uncertainty picture. And it's worth noting that Lev himself seems to have something quite different in mind with his arguments. Lev seems to think of himself as having discovered the sort of uncertainty that can make space in an Everettian universe, that can make room in an Everettian universe for the introduction of a new, freestanding, fundamental quantum mechanical law of chances, of the kind that I guess David mentioned at the very end of his talk, in the event that the argument from equivalence doesn't work out. Suppose, says Lev, that I make the following arrangements. I arrange to be put to sleep. And once I'm asleep, a measurement of the X spin of an initially Y spin up electron is carried out. And if the outcome of that measurement is up, or rather in the branch where the outcome of that measurement is up, my sleeping body is conveyed to a room in Cleveland. And if the outcome of that measurement is down, or rather in the branch where the outcome of that measurement is down, my sleeping body is conveyed to an identical room in Los Angeles. And then I'm awakened. It seems right to say, then, that on being awakened, I am simply, genuinely, flat-footedly, familiarly uncertain of what city I'm in. The trouble with Lev's uncertainty is that it seems altogether avoidable and that it comes too late in the game. The uncertainty we need, the uncertainty that quantum mechanics imposes on us, is something not to be bypassed, something that comes up whether or not we go out of our way to keep ourselves in the dark about anything, something that comes up no matter what pains we may take to know all we can, something that comes up not after experiments are over, but before they get started. Now, I think Lev is very likely to respond at least to this last complaint, the complaint, that is, that his uncertainty comes up too late in the game, like this. Suppose that the observer in the scenario described above knows all there is to know about the state of the world and about the equations of motion before the experiment gets underway. Among the things she knows, then, is that every single one of her descendants is with certainty going to be uncertain on being awakened about what city they're in. Moreover, that uncertainty does not arise in virtue of those descendants having forgotten everything, anything. They know everything that the pre-measurement observer knows. And so if there's something about the world of which these descendants are uncertain, the pre-measurement observer must have been uncertain about the same thing too, since once again there was no forgetting going on here. And what's being overlooked here, it seems to me, has to do with the locution about the world. The fact is that there is nothing whatsoever about the objective metaphysical future of the world of which the pre-measurement observer is uncertain. period, end of story. The question, the questions to which that observer's descendants do not have answers are questions which can only be raised in indexical language and only from perspectives which are not yet in the world at all before the measurement has been carried out. Completely new uncertainties do indeed come into being on this scenario once the measurement is done. But those uncertainties have nothing at all to do with objective metaphysical features of the world, and they are not the sorts of uncertainties that can only arise by means of somebody's forgetting something. Those new uncertainties have to do, rather, with the coming into being of completely new centers of subjectivity, from the standpoints of which completely new and previously unformulable indexical questions can come up. Thanks.
Feeling very strong. Nice to just sitting in front of me disagreeing. Jerry Fodor said that the problem with arguing that no abstract actually works is you need a cat block every now and then. There's always a possibility you can't. I probably need to quit and harsh on the possibility. I think the double standard here is not quite so strong as that. It's more that in the classical case we're sufficiently sure the answer must work out that we're willing to countenance kind of questionable moves and temporary steps that we haven't prepared in the other case. So I mean, if you want to say in the classical case, do we have arguments to rule out the saying, you know, whatever the previous said, I'm sure the next class going to spin up, just carry on saying that. Mm-hmm. Do we have arguments to say that's crazy?
To say what's crazy?
So in the classical strategy, I might adopt a series of measures. No matter what the previous said, the next class going to be spin up.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Now it seems. Yeah. It seems to me, it is a way of catching out the double standard, but it seems to me we don't have criticisms of that in the classical framework which are any more robust than the criticisms we have of, say, fabric rules in the Everestian framework. I claim they're less robust, but at the very least they're not more robust.
Let's see. I think we do. The objection is that that's not what happens. I mean, we can go into one doesn't want to extend this too far. It seems to me that a lot of what's said about, I mean, this is a particular issue within philosophy of probability. It seems to me that a lot of what's said in these discussions in terms of complaining about a double standard vastly underestimates the resources that, in particular, things in the general family of what we were calling frequentists have available. It looks to me completely independent of considerations in quantum mechanics. Indeed, this is a view that I was driven to take seriously by worries about probability and statistical mechanics. It looks to me like there are things that are in the general family of what you would call frequentist views that are very promising as accounts of probability in the classical. And these are accounts that, as you pointed out, are not going to carry over to the Everettian case at all. I guess it's just also true. I'm not sure what the attitude here is supposed to be. My attitude would be, as I said in the talk, look, if compelling arguments are ever really presented that such an analysis is out of the question, I guess I'm going home. You know, I don't know what to make of the scientific enterprise, if it can be compellingly argued that this problem is not merely profoundly difficult, but that there are ways of seeing that there can't be a link of the kind one is looking for between frequencies and probabilities.
So let's not pause on probability. Please, Joe, can't think I have this professor. Let me do something slightly different.
Right.
So you also brought up this issue of a fact that science won.
Right.
This is the tool, so this is the day of preemptive battle. So I don't think it's the preemptive response way. Let me try to close this response. Sure, there are lots of situations where ideal nationality is, you know, actual possibility falls short of ideal nationality. But there's maybe a certain amount of replicationism in what counts as rational behaviour. To some extent, this is linked to what rational, something about what actions we have available. And the point in the case of fatness is it's not just that we can't get that exactly right. There's no attainable form of behaviour which even counts as having a shot.
Well, let's see, that I don't understand. I mean, if we're going to play science fiction games here, I can imagine people who aren't particularly inclined to gorge or diet or something like that. They will apparently do okay under such circumstances. But look, like this seems to me to be giving away a point which I shouldn't be giving away. I don't understand. Take a chance, you theory. Okay, let's make believe that we all understand chance in a single outcome case, okay? Is there really a claim? So take a chancy theory where the chances depend on such detailed features of the state of the world or something that anything recognizable as agency is just ruled out, okay? Things are too crazy. Do you think imagining what I've just imagined is somehow incoherent?
Yes.
I see. Okay.
Because of the conceptual connection between chance and action.
So this is a real difference on philosophy of probability. I think the connection is much more primary between chance and frequency. And what counts as rational activity follows from that. You're seeing a more primitive connection between chance and action. I'm willing to make a sociological bet here. I don't know how much weight that carries. That if I ask physicists if they can imagine a kind of theory, if they can coherently imagine the kind of theory I just described.
But it kind of doesn't matter, because that would drop out. I mean, if it turns out that, you know, again, and that would start being a question of how we use words. I mean, if it turns out that all we get in error is quasi probability, which doesn't happen, it's just a sexual link. If we had that would still be enough to do the work.
Because in order to do the work as confirmation and so on and so forth, what it's got to be explaining is the observed frequency.
Can I chip in here? So here's the connection between probability and frequency. That we have a trial of a certain kind, results are, the probability of result R is P, then we perform a number of trials, then we know that the frequency will approximate P with high probability. That's the connection between probability and frequency. But of course, that connection directions commitment. We can just do the whole thing the same with weights.
Yes.
So you
that's
have
the kind of connection Lewis.
You must have exactly, but yeah. So let's just go around saying, well, of course we have a connection between probability and frequency, because that connection, the one that's shared, most of us think will do all the work.
Right.
You have in mind you want some tighter connection.
Yes.
But all the examples of tighter connections are horrible and don't do any work.
Well,
I think you have to.
I mean, I guess I can't complain after this talk about calling people names. You're going to need to talk me out of detailed, thoughtful proposals that seem to me very promising along those lines, like Lewis's and Barry Lowe's. And it looks like a lot of the way this discussion comes out may hinge on discussions like that.
One point of confusion, you know, several times it's been mentioned that there are some difficulties with certain classes of arguments on the grounds of the set of histories is infinite.
Right.
And physically realistic ones, it's generally finite because you avail yourself, you're only focusing on a certain number of things and there's a class of none of the above. So why can't your argument make use of a set of three histories where you're bigger than 200 pounds, less than 200 pounds?
I mean, if that's, you know, that wasn't a crucial point one way or another in what I was saying. If that's true, there's one paragraph from this paper that I could eliminate, where I went from the what I call the naive fatness measure to the sophisticated fatness measure. But the sophisticated fatness measure does the job of making the point I want to make anyway. So nothing hinges very much on how reasonable it is to pretend that there are always a finite and determinate number of branches.
Since human beings typically have only a finite amount of data.
Well, let's see. But that doesn't seem to be the. David and I may be taking this much more seriously as a metaphysically realist proposal about the world, rather than just as an instrument for doing calculations, than you may be taking it.
That's very likely.
Right.
The previous experience.
Right.
You know that. But, I mean, then you're going to have a hard time defining what the infinite set is. You have to do something like
that. No, but the advantage of the sophisticated proposal is that it doesn't require it.
No, I'm not arguing about your particular proposal, but it's going to be hard to define a set that is...
I agree.
Because we don't have any fine-grained incoherent sets.
I agree.
So you have to go to the notion of maximal fineness.
I agree. I agree. I think most of the speakers agree. Yeah, I agree.
Put it this way, this is a problem probably for me rather than for Dave.
Right.
I mentioned
right.
Several times already.
Silence next. Yeah, I suppose my main question is the very quick way in which you put to one side the issue of there is a place for uncertainty in the
bunch. Much too quick, yeah, and I'm sorry about that. It was just time constraints.
Right.
Quick, and also because I'm not 100% sure I know what I think about
it. But just a couple of comments. I mean, it seems to me that in the specific case that you offer the fatness and so forth.
Right.
You did repeatedly gesture towards care and concern for all of your descendants.
Mm-hmm.
And there's more of you than fat. And I just don't know that any of that sort of argumentation gets any traction if there's a place for uncertainty. Because one isn't concerned with all of them, one is concerned for oneself, and one doesn't know which. Is. And the business about, oh, the fat one is the one I'm going to, whatever. I mean, I don't get the right.
Well,
And I think there is somewhere where you can go here. And I have a little puzzle of my own. I mean, what happens if you've got this view that every time there's a branching event, you make a little four leaf clover?
Right.
And the little four leaf clover is going to be the one that you're going to count in the cobble one.
Right. You mean one of the branches makes
that's
it.
That's right.
Yes.
One of the branches.
Yeah, that's right. One thing that's often occurred to me, if I wanted to grant the point that it does count how practical all this is, which I don't think I want to grant, but if I wanted to grant that point, sure, the kind of thing that always occurred to me is, oh, make it something that happens at the beginning, right at the beginning of the branching, and it only counts what my weight is, right after the branching occurs, or something like that. One can go on for, there might be problems with that. This is why I was pressing David to produce out of the symmetry argument a very general diagnosis of what was necessarily going to be wrong with all set
proposals. I just want to say one little worry I have about that sort of kind of experience. And then I want to comment on the other side of it, which is the confirmation theory.
Right.
Just to comment on the four-leaf clover business, I mean, I don't really know what to make of this, but here's a parallel. It's not quite the same,
right.
It's a parallel. And that is that you'll say, look, I've got a view about the nature of time. And the nature of time it better be the case that there are time machines.
Right.
And then somebody comes along with a theory, and there aren't any time machines.
Right.
And the objection is, well, look, I don't think this theory is acceptable because maybe they could be time machines and your theory is ruling that out.
Right.
Now that's not a good parallel in certain ways because the issue here is rationality.
Right.
But somehow there is a remaining worry for me that to insist that it must be rational to be superstitious, which is effectively what the Pauli proposes as instance. That seems to be really kind of a weak objection. If that's what it all boils down to, look, I'm rejecting the rationality arguments because I claim it's reasonable to be superstitious.
Right.
Or, yeah, anyway, I just want to give you that. Okay. You can have that objection.
So, before you go on to the next, I mean, I think you're raising really interesting and hard questions here. And I'm not sure I know what to say to that until the end. But there are a couple of preliminary clarificatory points. Point one. I have thought that there is a, let me quote you back to yourself. In the recent paper with David, maybe I'm quoting David, anyway, you guys say, look, here's the deal. We have these arguments from the decision theoretic literature that something like, if there is a right value for the probability, here's what it is. What's still missing is an argument that it's coherent to talk about probabilities at all, and that's what we're going to provide with our semantic analysis. Good. There was a, it puzzled me a little bit reading a line like that. Gee, but I'm not sure I understand what that means, because the way those arguments are usually formed, we're taking it for granted that there is no uncertainty. That there is branching, but I took it. I guess what I took you to mean is that the same argument would go through with the same steps, just replacing the word caring with the word probability, if there was uncertainty. And then the worry was that the fatness objection would go through in the same way with the same replacement as well. But I might have been missing what you intended there altogether. I don't know.
I think it's a similar conversation a couple of months ago where you cited that paper, and I rather disagreed with the citation.
Oh, okay.
So, okay. I'm sorry. David, I don't think we particularly mentioned the decision theory on this at all.
Oh,
but maybe
you know what I think I have here. Let's just have a look. Do I have it here? I'm sorry, I don't have it. You don't remember the line I'm referring to? You say, look, there's a persistent worry about Everettian quantum mechanics, about whether one can make sense of probability. There is a whole string of arguments in the literature, and you refer to the Deutsch-Wallace papers, that there can't be any other numbers to assign to the probabilities than these. The papers you're referring to are the decision theory.
May I just make a bit
of subject? Sure.
I've never myself found very plausible deductions of the Bohrian in the absence of a notion of uncertainty.
Right, okay.
That's just a personal comment on
my
take on this. So that's why I'd be a little bit surprised if that's
the
case. Can we just move on to the confirmation theory?
Right, sure.
Because it did seem to me that almost everything you had to say against what Hillary and Wayne were doing was directed that there is this totally new thing, this caring measure, which is ultimately probability of chance.
Right.
And I just wonder how much of that argument does remain if chances make sense, if uncertainty makes sense. I don't really have any idea at all what the argument is going to be against them.
Look,
if that's so.
I guess here's what I'm puzzled with. Here's what I'm puzzled about. Suppose that, I don't know if this is specifically addressed to the confirmation issue rather than the issue more generally. This may be a long conversation, but here's something that I just that I'm just genuinely puzzled about.
Actually,
suppose I take the attitude by this semantic analysis or by Lev's example or something like that, I have cleared a space for ignorance within the ever picture. And my proposal is to inject probabilities into this space. Forget about deriving them. Take the more modest approach that they would. I'm going to inject them. It's a new law, okay? It's a new fundamental law. It's an additional fundamental law, okay? I'm not sure I know what this additional fundamental law is about, okay? It isn't a law regarding the future evolution of what amounts to a complete metaphysical picture of the world. That's already nailed down before this law has been inserted. And this is an interesting difference between probabilities in a theory, in a conventional chancy theory like GRW, and probabilities in the kind of ignorance theory that you're proposing. Those laws do indeed affect how we bet, but they affect how we bet through making different claims about the probabilities of future evolutions of, you know, of what is accepted within the fundamental metaphysical picture of the world. Yours doesn't operate there, okay? Yours seems to be the kind of probabilities that we're apparently dealing with in the picture that you guys are imagining are more like self-located probabilities. And if that's the case, I don't understand. So you have an idea that the self-locating probability I ought to assign to one or to finding myself here or there depends on physical characteristics of the world. There are certain characteristics of the world which suck my soul or whatever it is towards this direction, as opposed. So it's like if somebody says, here's the deal. There's a guy here in a certain brain state and a guy here in an identical brain state, okay? And I notice by introspection that this is my brain state, okay? And I also know that there's a really large mass here and a tiny mass over here. And somebody says, oh, here's the deal. You're probably in this one because the mass pulls you toward, you know, the probability. It seems crazy. It seems crazy that it should depend on physical characteristics of the world at all. It's not something that's playing any role in the evolution of, in the physical or even the fundamental metaphysical evolution. I tend to be skeptical about self-locating probabilities altogether, but forget about me. The people who aren't skeptical about self-locating probability, there's never a claim anything like it depends on the physical circumstances of the world. There are these two guys you might be, and there's some sort of a priori rational way of dividing your credits between them.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand that.
Yeah, maybe we should move on to the next. This is
I'm sorry, but I just spent the time lecturing and
not what I'm saying. I'm sorry. It's going on for ideas. Wrap you up?
Yeah, I was curious, you indicated that you thought there were some analyses that did a much better job of making sense of ordinary probability.
Yes.
And, I mean, one that didn't come up explicitly, I mean, I'd be curious to hear a little more about that. One that didn't come up explicitly, I've been told it sometimes goes by the name of Cournot's principle. It appears, if one can believe Wikipedia, it appears to have been almost the dominant view on the meaning of probability for about 50 years in the last century, including the view of Kolmogorov and many of the people that we think of as the founders of modern probability.
Say just one sentence about what the view is.
This view is that the meaning of probability is that events of sufficiently small probability don't happen. They're precluded.
Oh.
If you want to use that word.
I see.
Now, I can see it's not perfect.
But the view I'm thinking of is not unrelated to it.
It looks to me like it does a pretty good job.
I think the Lewisian sort of best system picture is more sophisticated than that, and it allows for events of very low probability to happen, but it's not unrelated to the kind of view you're talking about. That's right. That very, very crudely speaking, but this is very crude. Yeah, this view is something like what's meant by the claim, the probability of such and such a sort of event is such and such, is that the frequencies of those events are going to be sort of close to its probability, modulo all kinds of other things. I mean, this ties in with a view of what laws are generally, and so on and so forth. But it's not unrelated to the kind of view you're describing. Yes. Yes.
Yeah, and this handles many individual cases as well, mm-hmm. as long as mm-hmm. the probability
I agree.
Is small
yeah,
enough,
it's
sort of assimilated to the individual.
There's a good deal in common, at least in spirit, between the view I'm thinking of and the view you're describing. Yes. Yes.
Can I ask
a small point. It seems that this issue about whether things can be justified is critical between you and the other guy.
Yeah.
And at one point, the suggestion came up that your fatness or modified fatness pairing measure would somehow be irrational because it would have to change over time, and you seem to be giving weight along those lines, saying, well, so what if my descendants don't have the same measure with me? So what? And I want to
No. There are two different issues.
I have finished.
Okay, perfect. Sorry.
If you were doing that, and kind
yes.
of misunderstood, you shouldn't. Because your descendants can have the same preference for fatness that you do. As long as it's not a preference that, given to determinate choices.
Right.
Okay, if all of me goes one way or another.
Right.
I'm going to go for the fat.
No, that's right. No, that's true. I think the worry was more like, the worry David was raising was, and like I say, I can think of two categories of responses to this, one of which I think is deeper than the other. The first way to respond is to try to be more clever and think of things like the four-leaf clover and so on, where there's going to be less, where stories about making it difficult to operate with this measure are going to be more difficult to come up with, or more prima facie plausible or something like that. But I guess I don't think that's the basic, okay? It looks perfectly coherent to me to talk about a world in which the chances are such that the chances are so complicated or chaotic that agency doesn't make any sense, okay? And I just don't, you know, my intuition rebels very strongly against saying, oh, the world you just described is incoherent or unimaginable, or chances don't mean anything in that world, or something like that. I think I forgot your question. So let's see. So I think, maybe I can forget your question. What's true about branching theories, I think, I'm not sure if this is what you meant to deny. I think it's often going to be true, but it's perfectly reasonable that it's true, that the interests of my descendants vis-a-vis themselves are not the same as my interests, because my interests in some sense embrace all of my descendants. Okay. But there's nothing surprising. Right.
It would be worrying if their interests changed radically over short intervals and there was a lot of
right, right. I agree. Right. No, they don't have to. I agree with you. I see what you're saying. Good.
Can you leave it there? Thank you.